Did you catch the line in there about smiling through thy tears? That's a very Elgarian sentiment. He described the theme in one of his more intimate works as smiling with a sigh. When it comes to Elgar's personal involvement in the Coronation Ode, how much is this a matter of straightforwardly subscribing to imperialist sentiments? We have to remember here that Elgar was an outsider. He was the son of a lowly music shopkeeper. His family couldn't remotely afford a private education, and in fact he left school at 15. He was almost entirely self-taught, and had a bit of a chip on his shoulder about that for the whole of his life. And he was a Roman Catholic, at a time when in staunchly Protestant England that still mattered. In 1902, the year of the coronation, the Dream of Gerontius was proposed for the Three Choirs Festival. The Bishop of Worcester, Elgar's hometown, objected, and he had strong support. Gerontius wasn't performed in the cathedral in whose shadow Elgar grew up until it had been thoroughly purged of popish elements. Mary, prayers to saints, purgatory, all that sort of thing. For all the fact that he looks out of his photographs at us as, at the very least, a self-made Edwardian gentleman, Elgar was also acutely conscious of being an outsider. His wife Alice once said that he only ever looked completely at ease in Italy or the Bavarian Alps, where the class thing obviously didn't matter. Elgar wanted to belong, yet he was also very much aware that in a deep sense he didn't. Yet there could also have been, perhaps, an element of identification with the new king. Edward VII had had to wait until he was 60 to inherit his title. Elgar had had to wait until his very late 40s for his first real breakthrough, the premiere of the Enigma Variations. The fact that they were both Edwards, that can't have counted for nothing. But there are stories from the time which give hints of further identification. At the time of the coronation, Elgar wondered to his friend Rosa Burley how the king would cope with it all, this gala concert including the premiere of the ode, after reviewing the fleet at Spithead. A trying affair indeed, with the glare of the sun and the booming guns, followed by the train journey. The hypersensitive Elgar seems to be putting himself in the king's place. But then, very characteristically, Elgar added, "I think you'll find he'll do it, though." That's a very nice Elgarian mood swing there. Did Elgar guess also, perhaps, that with the coronation ode, the composer himself would be marking the beginning of his own enthronement as Britain's composer laureate? As I said before, Edward VII was the presiding monarch over Elgar's own royal years. After the king's death and the accession of George V in 1911, there were signs of a decline in Elgar's prestige. Then came the devastation of World War I. But even at the height of Elgar's success, his mood, his persona, you might say, could slip suddenly and surprisingly. Take the First Symphony. It begins with a superb nobilmente tune. This subsides, and suddenly there's a lurch in key, texture, mood, everything. Thank you. As with so many things in his life, Elgar's feelings about the coronation ode and the planned gala premiere at Covent Garden swung intensely. Especially when his remark, "I think you'll find that he'll do it, though," turned out to be wrong. The king was taken seriously ill, and so the coronation and all the celebration associated with it had to be postponed. I have to bring in a little personal element here. Elgar got the news while he was cycling in Herefordshire. He visited the church in the tiny village of Stretton Grandison, taking tea afterwards in the pub, when in burst the innkeeper's wife with the news that the coronation had been postponed. According to Rosa Burley, who was cycling with him, Elgar was devastated. "It was a terrible disappointment for Edward," she tells us, "who once again had to face the shattering of bright hopes, and he returned home in gloomy anticipation of the blow which must of necessity fall on poor Alice. Edward found consolation in action. During the next few days we covered enormous distances on our bicycles." So what's the personal element I mentioned? Well, when I first moved down to Herefordshire 12 years ago, I rented the cottage by the church in Stretton Grandison, where people often prop up their bicycles when visiting the church, and where Elgar almost certainly lent his. Also, the nearest tavern in the area is well over a mile away, yet I found out just before we left the cottage that it had doubled up as a pub. So it's just possible that Elgar got that devastating news in the front room of my house. I don't know whether to be proud of that or not. But hang on a minute. I said the news was devastating. If you look at a letter Elgar wrote to his friend and publisher August Jaeger, the Nimrod of the Enigma Variations, he seems to be telling a very different story. "Don't, for heaven's sake, sympathise with me. I don't care a tinker's damn. I was biking out in Herefordshire yesterday and the news reached me at a little roadside pub. I said, 'Give me another pint of cider. I'm deadly sorry for the king, but that's all.'" So terrible disappointment becomes a tinker's damn, just as tea becomes cider. It's so hard to gauge the true Elgar. In the end, the music has to be the testimony, and I can't help feeling moved by the touching simplicity of the tribute to Edward VII's spouse, Queen Alexandra. Now, she was Danish, and that's reflected in the words. Surely this music has to come from the heart, insofar as anyone can judge such things. So what have we got here? Is this an expression of wholehearted imperialist sentiment? Or is it qualified? Is this the idealism of the outsider, made all the more intense and poignant because it's written by someone who's not quite one of us? Or is there an element of identification with the king, or a sense that Elgar's own coronation was now at hand? It's complicated. And it may be difficult even for English ears to enjoy it today without at least a touch of ironic distancing. Yet there is heart in this music, and some striking invention. And at the very least, it's interesting. You could call it a period piece if you like. And you may still find that some of it has a way of getting through your defences.
Stephen Johnson discovering music, and a warm welcome back to the first night of the Proms, where Edward Gardner will conduct the Coronation Ode in about 20 minutes' time. He is with me now at the back of the stalls. I think we're about to get the first Prommers announcement of the season.
There we go.
You ended last year's Proms conducting the last night, then starting this season with that fantastic opener from Mark Anthony Turnage.
Yeah, it's such a privilege to do that, actually, and I think Mark's written such a fiery piece, and how wonderful to start this extraordinary festival with a new piece of British music. I think it was a great privilege to be up there with all those wonderful, wonderful players.
It's such a treat, isn't it, to be back here once again with the season stretching ahead of us, which of course will fly by in no
Absolutely,
time at all.
Yes.
But to see the Prommers out there, to see this place so full is so exciting.
It is, it really is. There's an atmosphere to itself, and it's the warmest atmosphere you ever perform in. You feel like you're being embraced by the audience rather than critiqued, and that's kind of the biggest accolade I could give it.
You'll be back later in the season with ENO.
That's right. We're coming to Peter Grimes, which is something, I mean, it's something I've been looking forward to for years. It's sort of highlight of everything I've done up to now, really, because ENO haven't been at the Proms for a while. I think everyone there's performing so well, and I think we have a great cast, very similar to the one that we performed in 2009, and I think it's going to be a really great night, something I'm really looking forward to.
You were saying there's a strange thing about sharing the platform with all these conductors, that there's a lot of sitting around.
It's so weird, because normally you just come in and you start rehearsing and you finish rehearsing at the end of the rehearsal, and then you do the whole performance yourself. So it's very, very strange and slightly surreal to be backstage during your own concert.
Well, it's a fantastic relay of baton passing between yourself and three other names, including Mark Elder, who, of course, your mentor in many
Absolutely,
ways back in
yeah.
the days when you were assistant at the Halle.
No, he's an incredible mentor to me, and you know, now a friend, still a mentor. And it's lovely to share the platform with him, actually.
We're going to let you go and take a seat for the next work on the programme. Then we'll hear you conducting the Coronation Ode in 20 minutes or so. Thank you very much, Ed Gardner, for joining us here at the first night of the Proms. We're going to hear Michael Tippett's Suite for the Birthday of Prince Charles before Elgar's Coronation Ode, written in 1948 after the BBC asked Tippett for a work to celebrate the arrival of the Queen's first child. Five movements, the first a chorale prelude on the hymn tune Crimond, to evoke the wedding of Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip the previous year. Third movement uses a tune from Tippett's opera A Midsummer Marriage, along with an Irish version of the fertility jig Around My Hat. And the fifth and final movement, based on the folk song Early One Morning, and, rather excitingly, the Helston Furry Dance, a piece of music from my hometown in Cornwall. Maybe something of an occasional work, but it really is filled with great skill and craftsmanship. Very appealing, very richly scored. Martin Brabin's exactly the man to conduct it. He has got a baton, so the relay is back on track. Martin Brabin's conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra here at the first night of the Proms. Sir Michael Tippett's Suite for the Birthday of Prince Charles. Martin Brabbins conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Michael Tippett's Suite for the Birthday of Prince Charles, written in 1948. How appropriate to end with a piece based on early one morning in the Helston Floral Dance for a man who would later in his life become Duke of Cornwall. Wonderful picture in the Proms programme tonight of the present Queen, then Princess Elizabeth, looking radiant as she beams over her five-week-old son, lying in a crib, surrounded by cotton and silk. bbc.co.uk/proms if you'd like to look at the programmes online. They're available just before each concert. A wealth of resources at the website. More things, it seems to me, every year. Do have a look. bbc.co.uk/proms. Herbert Howells and Gordon Jacob were the other composers commissioned by the BBC for the occasion of the birth of Prince Charles. So here we are in the final stages of the first night of the BBC Proms 2012. Two stage works to come over the opening weekend. My Fair Lady, starring Anthony Andrews as Henry Higgins and Annalene Beechey as Eliza Doolittle. That's with the John Wilson Orchestra tomorrow. And on Sunday, Sir John Eliot Gardner conducts Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande. To conclude this evening, Elgar's Coronation Ode, written first for the coronation of Edward VII, then extensively revised 9 years later for George V. Patriotic and majestic, it includes an early version of Land of Hope and Glory, yet as tonight's mezzo-soprano soloist Sarah Connolly points out, the whole piece is also very reflective.
It's an extraordinary introspective piece in many ways. It's very much to do with peace and peace of the nation and of the lands, and unfortunately, you know, being performed and written in 1911, it's written earlier, but it was performed in 1911, as the beginning of the First World War and the gathering forces. It's almost a sort of cry for peace and not anti-war, but trying to point out the value of not being an aggressive nation.
So it's for soloists and for chorus. How does it fit into the world of Elgar's oratorios, like the Apostles, that we're going to hear later on this season?
Well, there are many quotes from the Apostles or references to Gerontius as well. And it's beautiful to hear the orchestration. He loved sixths in the strings, in minor keys as well, sixths in minor keys. The major minor thing for him was very important. He would end up having done a whole page of painful sentimental music and then ending with the sun coming out, going into this beautiful, never saccharine, but beautiful, warming sentiments. And even when I get to sing Land of Hope and Glory, it's quite serious. And it's lovely to be able to sing it as he wrote pianissimo and piano, so that when everybody comes in a minute later, it suddenly becomes an enormous anthem.
Sarah Connolly talking to me earlier on today. So it is reflective, it is patriotic in places, but also no doubt it's about war, reflecting the Boer War, first written in the aftermath of that, and then the industrialisation of the war machine before World War I. Susan Gritton, Robert Murray, Gerald Finlay with Sarah Connolly, Edward Gardner to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra and BBC Symphony Chorus in this Proms performance of the 1911 version of Sir Edward Elgar's Coronation Ode.
thy sons be strong.
Send thy sons be strong.
Strong as thy sons go in heaven. The water
send thy sons be strong.
See that thy navy speed to the sound of the battle song.
When the winds are up,
and see that thy sons be strong. See that thy squadrons haste when loosed are the hounds of
hell.
Bless our meets our love.
Land of Hope and Glory in its original version, ending Sir Edward Elgar's Coronation Ode. Susan Gritton, soprano, Sarah Connolly, mezzo-soprano, Robert Murray, tenor, and Gerald Finlay, bass baritone, with the BBC Symphony Chorus and BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted at this first night of the 2012 proms by Edward Gardner. What wonderful synergy that the next time we'll hear that tune will be in 8 weeks' time at the last night. Sir Edward Gardner ended the 2011 season of the proms and then began this new season here at the Royal Albert Hall earlier this evening with that fanfare by Mark Anthony Turnage. After the 1982 premiere of the Coronation Ode, Elgar's publishers Boothie and Hawkes saw the great commercial possibilities of Land of Hope and Glory and persuaded him to turn it into a separate standalone work, which he did with his librettist A.C. Benson, Arthur Benson. Clara Butt premiered it that year, Benson adding the now famous lines, "Wider still and wider shall thy bounds be set." Stephen Jackson, chorus master of the BBC Symphony Chorus, centre of the stage now, applauding his choral forces, who of course will return multiple times over this prom season, as will the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The hardest working musicians across the prom season, no doubt about that. They stand to their feet now, Stephen Bryant leading them this evening. Sarah Connolly off to another music festival tomorrow. Yes, other music festivals do exist. She's at Cheltenham, singing in Holst's chamber opera, Savitri. And then she'll be teaming up with Bryn Terville to sing, as she puts it, Mrs. Votan, opposite him at Covent Garden in the autumn. And here come the remainder of the lineup of the evening. The three other conductors taking part in this Olympic-inspired relay race. Sir Roger Norrington, Martin Brabbins, and Sir Mark Elder. Bryn Terville with them on stage as well. Actually, Mark Elder, no stranger to sharing duties at a prom. Back in 1977, he shared a prom platform with Adrian Bolt. Bolt conducted Brahms, Elder Ravel, and a work by John Buller. Well, what a start to this 2012 season of proms, which continues night after night for the next 8 weeks. For now, from the Royal Albert Hall, very good night to you. Back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Petrarch, thank you very much indeed. Petrarch Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight, live here on BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. And you can hear every one of those concerts from the Albert Hall here on Radio 3. If you'd like to hear that prom again, there's a second chance to do so when we launch the first of our BBC Proms repeats programmes. That's on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And it follows the very first BBC Proms chamber recital of the new season. We're going to be live at Cadogan Hall in London on Monday to hear a recital given by the celebrated British mezzo Alice Coote with the pianist Julius Drake, and a programme of mostly French songs, Poulenc and Fauré, Gounod and Satie. That's all at 1 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3 on Monday lunchtime. Well, we're back at the BBC Proms tomorrow night when you can hear John Wilson make his next big appearance at the festival. This is his fourth big appearance at the Proms, by my reckoning. He's given us tours of the MGM musicals, the work of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and the golden age of Hollywood. Each one has been a tremendously exciting and impressive show, and this year's promises to be just as good. He's going to be conducting his own orchestra, once again, a team of hand-picked musicians, and an all-star cast in a performance of Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady. It's all live here on BBC Radio 3, beginning at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Should be good. Well, it's 4 minutes to 10 now, and next tonight, The Verb will be explaining inverse, the Higgs boson particle. And you can hear music that's a blend of opera and pop song cycle by one of the great pop singer-songwriters of his generation. Hear who he is when you meet The Verb with Ian McMillan at 10 o'clock tonight. Well, to take us there, the music of Chopin in the hands of another Proms performer this season. Looking ahead to the middle of August, our Prom on the 15th is going to include a performance by the Brazilian pianist Nelson Freire. He'll be playing Villa Lobos on that occasion, but here he is now playing one of Chopin's nocturnes. Nelson Freire playing the nocturne in C-sharp minor. That's the final one of the 20 nocturnes by Chopin. And as I say, you can hear Nelson Freire in the Prom on the 15th of August when he teams up with the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra. They're going to be conducted by Marin Alsop. Well, a very good evening to you. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and in high definition online. It's just after 10 o'clock. Next tonight, The Verb with Ian McMillan.
Welcome to the last verb of the current season. And because we won't be around until the apples are ripe and the leaves are turning browner than my Uncle Charlie's waistcoat, we thought we'd leave you with enough mental stimulation and cultural satisfaction to keep you going until September. Last week, scientists found the God particle. It was hiding on the back of a barn owl in Uttoxeter, apparently. This week, we find proof that quantum physics and fiction have a more than perceptible effect on each other. We've commissioned new flash fiction from Tanya Hirschman, who believes that good writing is a slap in the face. You should reel from it. Her workshops must really sting. the novelist and scientist and, let's face it, dreamer, Charles Fernio, is here with theories that tie memory into storytelling via neurons, synapses and epiphanies. Paul Heaton's new musical project came to him in a dream, and it's an extension of his craft as a songwriter into something beyond the 3 minutes of gorgeous memorability that he loves to give us. And memory and dreamland and that oddly addictive place between the page and the eye are the settings for Julia Korpus's mysterious poems that try to pivot the self in time. Let's begin, though, with a bit of flash fiction on a Friday night. Part short story, part prose poem, part anecdote, part glimpse into a complex world. Tanya Hirschman is one of flash fiction's leading advocates and exponents in this country, writing it, teaching it and editing a journal called The Short Review. She worked for years as a science writer, but gave it all up for fiction, which is, after all, simply science with plots and believable characters. For The Verb, we've asked Tanya to write our first ever piece of flash fiction. She joined us earlier from The Verb's Bristol studio to read Massless.
"Quark me," he hissed, sliding up in the dark. "Go on, quark me." "No way," I said. "You're charmed, mate, if you think I'd..." "Bloody hell," he said. You're totally massless, you are, totally." And he held up his fingers right in front of my face. Gave me the boson, the sod. He always did like to mess with me, with my head. That was the last time. I've not seen him since. He made like a neutrino, just spun off, slipped away. I didn't worry at first. I had what to worry about, what to keep me busy with my particles and all that. Wasn't that enough? Didn't I have it snowed under? So I didn't miss him. But then, sudden, from 1 minute to the next, I felt him. Felt him undone, like he'd been antied. Like he'd been black-holed and no one cared, no one gave a flying fermion. Of course, I went to the authorities and told them. I tried to, anyway. They looked like they were listening. Looked like they were paying a Higgs bit of notice. They filed their whatevers under this and that. But I never saw a photon of evidence that they were searching for him. Really searching. I still hear him, sometimes, on the edge of a dream. "Quark me," he's saying, whispering it softly, almost romantic. "Quark me, go on, just do it." And when I hear him, I wish I had. I really wish I had.
Tanya, thank you very much. That's a fantastic piece of writing. I wonder if you always found that sort of language exciting, even when you were a science journalist.
I definitely did when I was a science journalist. When I was actually studying physics, I was too worried about having to remember what all these things actually meant. So at least when I was a science journalist, it was okay to ask lots and lots of questions. But when I was a journalist, I was writing about so many different things, not just physics, all sorts of things and technology, and everything was weird and wonderful. I loved it. But it's better now being a fiction writer because I just get to play with it.
Well, that's right. You seem to have taken charge of the language and put your own stamp on it. And I like the way you put the humour in, the way the quantum physics language, you say, "He gave me the boson." And that gives us a fantastic visual image, but also it releases us from being, as lay people, nervous of the language, doesn't it?
I think that's a really interesting point. I'm wondering whether I feel like I have license to do that with this language because I've studied some physics, and that probably if you haven't got a background in science, you probably feel that you have to stick with it and be very rigid with what these words mean to science. Whereas because I have a bit of a background, even though I'm not sure I could tell you exactly what a fermion was anymore, I feel like I'm allowed to be a bit playful. And I think humour's kind of important as well, because science is so often seen as quite rigid and black and white and not necessarily associated with anything funny.
But also, somehow, this language gives this breakup between these almost lovers a kind of grandeur and mystery. When you say things like, "felt him undone, like he'd been anted, like he'd been black-holed and no one cared," you give it a real gloss of mystery there, I think.
Oh, thank you. I didn't, you know, it's hard to know how your own work is going to come across to other people, so that's really wonderful to hear.
But what it also does as well is it's almost like it's a private language between two scientists. You imagine if two greengrocers met each other, they'd use a kind of private greengrocer language.
Different,
and these people,
yeah.
they feel like they call each other "my old turnip" and stuff, and yet these people feel like they're using a kind of private science language that, on the one hand, is beguiling, but on the other hand, is keeping us away in a way.
Oh, I really, really like that. I hadn't thought of that either. That's wonderful.
Now, flash fiction often seems to me to live or die by its endings.
Mm.
This one doesn't so much, but often with flash fiction you get a kind of a da-da at the end or a broom-tsh.
Yeah, well, I think short stories in general are all about their endings because you can't really have a great short story that has a weak ending. So flash fiction, these tiny stories, are sort of the essence of that and distill that right down. The whole sort of twist in the tale type short story endings are a little bit out of fashion now, but I guess anything goes.
That was Tanya Hirschman in our Bristol studio. A new collection of very short fiction is published by Tangent Books and is called My Mother Was an Upright Piano. The language in there was fantastic. Words like quark and neutrino. I like strangeness, which is a branch of charm, I believe. Paul, wasn't there a song called Quark, Strangeness and Charm?
Not one of mine.
This is not yours, Paul. But I'm sure I remember a song that went quark, strangeness and charm. So, Charles, this physics language has got amazing resonance, hasn't it?
It does. The term quark comes from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. As a young man, I was obsessed with this book. I used to go around telling people that in 200 years' time, all books would be written this way. Quark is meant to represent the sound of seabirds. And one of the things I learned this week is that there's a special kind of quark, which involves a quark-antiquark pairing. And these things are called sea quarks, and they go around bumping into each other and obliterating each other. But I just thought it was a lovely twist on Joyce's maritime terminology.
Certainly is. Julia Corpus, do any of these words attract you?
Well, I know about the word gluon, which apparently is a type of boson responsible for the strong force between quarks. But to me, if I use that in a poem, I think I'd use the word gluon to refer to the sort of person who hangs on to you at a party that you can't get rid of. You know, they find you in the kitchen and they keep you talking for hours.
There's nothing worse than a gluon when they come towards you with their anecdotes. What about you, Paul? Some of this language of physics. And
I think boson, because it's like, I can imagine it's sort of like a buffalo-like particle that goes against the grain, you know, against the storm, because buffaloes go against the storm, don't they, and that's why they survive. And I imagine a boson just goes flying through it, everything that's coming towards it.
It's fantastic, this language. And the great thing about this language is that for those of us that don't quite understand it, we can use it in a poetic kind of way. Strangeness, that really is a fantastic word. Now, Charles Fernyhough is a scientist and a psychologist and a novelist whose latest book, Pieces of Light, is an enthralling investigation of that thing we call memory. What's really exciting about the book, from the Verbs point of view, is that Charles puts forward the current thinking amongst neurologists that memories aren't simply stored in mental versions of filing cabinets or CD racks, but are reinvented, composed, almost written each time we fish for them. So memory is a creative thing. And what's also flabbergasting from a writer's and reader's point of view is that Charles manages to write about complex things in a clear and understandable way. So, Charles, let's begin with an extract where you question your childhood memories of walking with your father along the River Blackwater.
After his divorce, my dad had found a welcome distraction in sailing. A friend of his, a whiskery schoolmaster named Monty Stanley, owned a 20-foot Bermuda sloop called Doralind, which he wintered in Malden and moored for the summer at West Mersey, a little further along the Blackwater coast. Dad had no investment in Doralind, but in return for his work on the boat, he got to sail with Monty whenever he wanted, and to bring us kids along when we were with him for the weekend. I was exposed to the mud early on. I would see it in the boatyard at Malden, where on winter weekends we would be painting the hull or trying to prise open tins of varnish with a screwdriver. The tide always seemed to be out, as though in conspiracy with my obsession. I wanted to know how deep a boy of my weight would go. Ankle deep? Knee deep? Would I really sink from sight completely? How many children in Malden's long history had been muddily snuffed out in this way? It trots off the tongue what Dad said to me about the mud and the complex fascination it inspired. It is the stuff of memoir, a vivid childhood memory freighted with significance and now seeming to contain an incontrovertible truth about one's own life. But I've learned too much about the fallibility of memory to be taken in so completely. I'm pretty sure about the sensory impressions, the stink of the river bottom, its gleam under a reflecting sky. I don't doubt the remembered cries of black-headed gulls, the constant tink-tink of lanyards against masts. I'm confident about the part of the memory that relates to facts about my life, those autobiographical details about what I was doing at what point in time. It was after the divorce and before I started at boarding school, which puts my age as between 6 and 10.
But that poignant story opener, my dad used to say, how much of that is my own making? I have no memory of him actually saying those words. In no version of the mental screenplay is he mouthing them. What I remember is the thought, you will disappear forever. Maybe what I want to say is that I know my father said it. Like I know that he was born in Newcastle-under-Lyme and that his last car was a Nissan Primera. But I might just as easily have put that warning into his mouth. It was my terror, after all, my fear driving the remembering. He is there in the memory, but his feelings are not propelling it. Memory serves its own master. It doesn't work for anyone's purposes except the rememberers. I'm going back to this moment on my own terms, not anyone else's.
Charles, that is really fascinating because you bravely allow us to enter and question the validity of your own memories as you interrogate the nature of memory itself. You question all kinds of details, you know, your dad's words in that extract, the colour of the carpet in another memory. And in one chapter, it transpires you once wrote a scene based on a real pool you could never have visited. And surprisingly, to me, it turns out that a strong sense of emotional attachment to a memory is no guarantee at all that it's accurate.
That's right. Emotional events tend to be remembered better, but they sort of stick in the mind more strongly, but they're not necessarily any less prone to distortion than our other memories are. And I think it's just one of the ways in which we see how complex memory is as a process. There are so many different cognitive, psychological and neurological functions going on when we remember the past.
So interesting, because we often think of memory as a simple thing, and yet, as you say, it's complex. And I know it's not the first time you've managed your own personal experience with science writing, but did you feel that this subject demanded it in some way?
My previous book was about my daughter's development, her psychological development in the first 3 years or so of her life. And there I was coming to this story, you know, as a scientist who knew about this stuff in the abstract, as a writer who wanted to make sense of this amazing new experience, but also as a dad who felt so emotionally connected. And so the form that suggested itself to me there was a kind of science book that read like a novel. And when I was thinking about a topic to follow up on, memory seemed to work very well because memories are about stories, memories are constructions, memories are in a sense fictions.
That's the thing about the fiction, because you say at one point in the book, memory narrativizes us. It turns us all into characters in a novel. And this understanding of memory is a creative process. Has that made you think about the original purpose of storytelling and why it's there?
One of the things we've learned from the new science of memory is that thinking about the past and thinking about the future seem to draw on similar processes, both in the brain but also cognitively in terms of what our minds are doing when we make sense of this information. What story gives us is a way of organising information, particularly information as it unfolds over time. Story allows us to put events together in time, and we need that when we're trying to make sense of our past. So I'm not trying to explain the ultimate function of storytelling. I think we should value stories in their own right. But there does seem to be an interesting evolutionary explanation for why thinking about the past and thinking about the future seem to fit together so well.
It's fascinating that neurologists' new model for memory seems to have got a lot in common with the way of thinking that Dark Ages monks would have understood. Could you explain something about the plan of St. Gall?
The medievals had a very sophisticated view of memory. What they remembered stuff for was in order to meditate, to create new thoughts about God, essentially. So they had a sense of memory as a reconstructive, recombinative process that would pull together different bits of information and stick them together in new ways. This is what the monks were up to for all those hours when they were meditating on spiritual matters. The Plan of St. Gall is a real-life plan for an abbey that was never actually built. It dates from the 9th century. And Mary Carruthers, who's a medievalist in New York, has argued that this abbey was never meant to be built. What this beautiful plan represents is an aid to memory. The idea is that the monks would study this plan and they would populate this imaginary space with the stuff that they knew. And so to create new thoughts, all they had to do was kind of take a walk around this abbey and see new ideas combine in new ways every time.
So it is a way of bringing memories together. And since I read your book, I've started thinking differently. And you write very movingly in the book about that man whose memories of an accident he was involved in affected his life. And he was compelled to keep telling himself the story of that day almost every day. And I wonder how writing this book has given you a sense of how you might cope in such a trauma, given your understanding of how memory works. In other words, once you know how memory works, and if something happened to you, do you think you would then look at the recovery in terms of a narrative in a different way?
I like to think so. It's very hard to judge when you haven't been through those terrible experiences to know how you would react. And I think these are very difficult things to deal with. But I think for all of us, we can learn something from this new consensus about memory, and we can give ourselves a bit of a break. You know, for example, I don't have particularly rich memories of my childhood. Why should I? You know, why is this assumption that we all have incredibly vivid memories of everything? I don't beat myself up over that. I don't beat myself up over the fact that I can't remember people's names. I can't remember basic information. I don't really care. That's not what my memory was designed for. It was designed for thinking ahead. It was designed for being creative, to my understanding.
That's a liberating thing to say. It really is. You know, it lets us off the hook in so many different ways. But what interests me as well is that from the book I get the idea that there's no single objective version of the self. There's no single Charles Fernyhough writing the books. And that's something you chose to explore in your new novel, Box of Birds, because the heroine there has an unconventional understanding of the self, doesn't she?
That's right. Neuroscience is everywhere. We're constantly being told about this new way of understanding ourselves in terms of mental, in terms of neurological processes, in terms of what our synapses are doing. And I thought, what if you took somebody who was really steeped in that stuff? She actually worked on this stuff for a living. She tried to understand the brain. Surely that would affect how she understood herself and possibly even why she chose to do what she did. So this is my question. Does knowing this new stuff about the brain actually change how we feel about ourselves? Does it change what we do? Is there a moral dimension to it? And so that's what I tried to explore in this story. Does this new understanding that Yvonne, my heroine, has, does it change how she feels about herself, how she behaves when things start to happen?
But you found also that fiction writers, and this is really interesting, find it hard to integrate this kind of thinking about the self into their work. So what do you make of their difficulty, do you think?
Fiction writers are very interesting on memory. I think we can learn an awful lot about how memory works by looking at how novelists construct memories for their characters. At the same time, sometimes novelists are very attached to a view of memory which is absolutely authentic, which suggests that when we remember something, we are really getting back to that original moment and recalling it in all its accurate detail. So I sometimes wonder why novelists don't celebrate the storytelling nature of memory a little bit more. But the same applies to memoirs. You know, when you read a memoir, you're sort of told, you're being told, you know, this is actually how things were. But it wasn't really how things were. It's how you're choosing to tell that story at this moment in time.
Certainly isn't. The book tells the story really, really well. Thank you very much to Charles Fernyhough. And Pieces of Light is out now from Profile. And his new novel, Box of Birds, is out with Unbound Books. Julia Corpus is one of my favourite poets of the human heart, of the unexpected image, of phrases that come back to you when you least expect them, on the bus, in the bath, halfway through the news. Last night I sensed a taking root under the bone cage of my heart, a stirring, shifting, something not quite of a breath or heartbeat's weight. Her latest collection, The World's Two Smallest Humans, is concerned with time, how we perceive it as a fulcrum, a tipping point from past to future, from the perspective of the present. She writes of love, of children, and, like Charles Fernyhough, she explores the idea of what memory is and how we can sculpt it to make it sing. So, Julia, let's start with a poem, A Soft-Edged Reed of Light.
A soft-edged reed of light. That was the house where you asked me to remain on the eve of my planned departure.